Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Emissions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. We're back onto heat pumps this week. So, apropos of seeing an interesting thread on Twitter about the UK's weirdness and bad vibes around heat pumps in the national discourse, we reached out to its author, Andrew Sissons, asked him if he'd fancy coming on the show to talk about it. For those who don't know him, and right enough, I didn't. Andrew Sissons is Deputy Mission Director at Nesta. Now, he's someone worth listening to for a variety of reasons, but he comes with institutional credibility and authority, having spent years at the Environment Agency as Deputy Director for Innovative Funding and Finance, and he was the Head of Devolution Strategy at the Department for Communities and Local Government, and he's been a Senior Policy Advisor in the Cabinet Office over the last decade. So he's been in the thick of it, if you pardon the pun. I didn't mean that. Anyway, he's right interesting. He had a lot of good ideas. I've thrown the thread into the show notes. It's one of them things, it's worth bookmarking. So we talked right around the houses on this. Experience working with government, market sentiment around heat pumps, the barriers to entry, gatekeepers, the peculiar situation of installers, heating engineers, as possibly the most influential people in the whole equation. We even get into the implications of the Future Homes Standard on gas boiler installation and by implication heat pumps. Just a little bit of housekeeping around context. This episode was recorded last Thursday on the day of the local elections in England. We appreciate there's not elections everywhere at that point. We also talk about the COP, that means coefficient of performance. So that's the ratio between the energy that's put in to a thing and the energy that comes out. So in the case of heat pumps, a COP of 3 means the heat pump supplies 3 times more heat energy as electrical energy goes into it. It's me and Jeff this week. I don't know if there's any more housekeeping. It's a fun episode. We enjoyed ourselves. Jeff had to bail early, sadly. But I think he said as much as he needed to. But that didn't hold up the conversation. Right, away. Thank you for joining us. Cheers.
Nice to meet you, Jeff.
No,
Dan, I think your connection might be a little bit shaky. Is that same for you, Jeff?
Really?
You did go a bit dodgy there for a second. Where are you? You're in Hastings, are you?
Right. Let me log off. I'll come back on. I'll be back in a second. I'll meet you, the host, Jeff.
So yeah, Andrew.
It's nice to meet you.
I saw a social media thread was it a Twitter thread that you put up on heat pumps?
Yeah.
Which it came to my attention before. I seem to get a fair bit of attention before Dan flagged it to me. It's very interesting. I have a few different hats that I wear. I am the publisher of Passive House Plus magazine, which we'll have to get you onto the mailing list for. And I also am the chair of the Heat Pump Association of Ireland.
Oh, nice.
We've been wrestling with, it's really interesting. There's been a shift in perspective in the green building community. And I mean the nerdiest data-driven elements of the green building community. Over the last couple of years, as the grid is decarbonizing and as people become more familiar with, you know, competently designed, installed and commissioned heat pumps, you know, night and day from the kind of stuff that went on, the free-for-all that went on under, say, the Clear Skies program, if you ever encountered that. So, you know, where the actual measured COPs are actually decent,
yeah,
rather than 2 or less, or something, horror kind of figures that were being posted in the past. And that is causing people to start excluding evangelical building fabric enthusiasts, to question the balance between the two. You know, we'd be slow to turn away from making arguments about the importance of doing good work on building fabric, but there are alternative ways, and, you know, one size does not fit all, you know?
Absolutely. Very much agree.
So you're back, Dan. It's even worse now. This is strange now. This is Brexit Britain. Everything's broken now.
I did talk to Dan. It must have been 2 days ago in the same spot, and it was absolutely fine. So,
right. I think it's my machine. I'll be back in just 1 minute. I'll just restart the machine.
Yeah. Anyway, Andrew, your own background, I would love to know a wee bit about that, because I gather it's impressive, but I shouldn't you know, I'd let you actually talk and say for yourself, you know.
Well, that's very kind. I guess, yeah, my background's a bit of a mix, actually. So I work now at Nesta, which is an innovation charity. And one of the big areas we focus on is on home heating and trying to decarbonize home heating as rapidly as possible, while obviously keeping people warm and with, you know, able to afford heating. So I've done a mix of different roles before that. So I worked for close to 10 years in different bits of the UK government. So I was at the Environment Agency for about 5 years before Nesta. And that's it's a big agency that basically looks after all of the, it basically deals with all the problems of climate change, as in the consequences. So it's like a big adaptation agency. It deals with floods, water, you know, drought, and sewage and the like, as well as regulation.
Yeah, lots of that. Yeah, at the moment.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of issues, but it's very much on the kind of, I guess, the receiving end of climate change. It was less about trying to reduce emissions and more about dealing with the consequences of emissions. And one of the things, if you speak to the various hydrologists and you know, people who deal with flood risk, they've been seeing the climate change stuff in their models for much, much longer. There's a lot of models which, you know, go back quite a long time, which suddenly don't work anymore because you can see how climate change just kind of changes the kind of rainfall patterns, the flow levels on rivers, which is really striking. So I did a range of roles there, but kind of particularly focused on economics and kind of funding and for the environment. Yeah, and then prior to that, I kind of worked in a slightly different field around economic growth and particularly sort of local economies. So I worked in central government in the UK in the kind of cabinet office and the local government department, working on creating the kind of metro mayors. So your Andy Burnhams and your Andy Streets, who are being currently being elected as we speak, kind of set those up. And I've done some other work. Yeah, before my government days, did some consultancy and some work on unemployment, the kind of 2008 crisis, unemployment growth, and where all the jobs were going to come back from. So
that's fascinating. Andrew, there's one of my pet subjects relates specifically to this. In 2008, when the music stopped on the Irish economy as well as it did initially, I was still the magazine that I publish, the progenitor to it, is Rich Ireland, which is a green building magazine we set up in 2003. We were dealing with trying to keep our business afloat. We had advertisers who we were, you know, calling them to try and get payment and being told, you know, sorry, like, you know, I've got your man. Big shot developer has gone to the wall, and he'd been using me basically as a bank, you know, getting like 100 boilers or whatever on credit, now I can't pay you basically. So there was a knock on effect from the developers through the contractors through the supply chain that they bought from, kind of a vicious cycle of damage being done. So we got talking to, there was an economist, a radical green economist called Richard Douthwaite. He's a wonderful guy. He used to write for us. Late, great Richard Douthwaite. I asked Richard to do some modeling for us on the impacts of, in that situation, of the government planning a retrofit, a massive kind of investment in retrofit to try and stop this hemorrhaging of companies and of jobs, right? So he put these figures together. And we went to the government's statistics agency, the CSO, the Central Statistics Office, to ask them for their input, basically, or their feedback on this. And they pointed us to the Scottish government's input-output team, their macroeconomics modelers. It was bizarre. The response we got from them was, you know, this the whole thesis of a big company going bust and a knock-on effect, they couldn't accept in their models. They had a steady state model, which assumed that demand is constant, so that if one company goes bust, somebody else steps into the breach to fill the gap. And that for me was jaw-dropping. It's one of those, you know, there's no grown-ups in charge moments, basically. So I wonder, I'm just ranting now, but how much of that relates to your experience? Be less cynical, or have you had a more positive experience of modeling and economics?
So I don't do heavy modeling, and I think models are really useful in whatever discipline. And the energy field is full of models as well. We love in energy. Everyone loves a model. I think you always have to treat models with caution and try and understand what's going in and what's driving the outputs. And ultimately, you can make a model tell you pretty much any answer you want if you change the inputs and the variables. That bit in a sense, often models are used to kind of confuse people and obfuscate, and it's very important to understand the dynamics and to be able to express in simple terms what's causing the output. So models are useful, but absolutely don't just trust the model at face value, because I don't think anyone who makes a model would believe that it's a true reflection of what's going to happen. It's meant to illustrate certain effects. And yeah, if you go around sort of believing your model will come true, you're in for a nasty surprise. Applies in economics, but it applies very much in energy as well.
For sure.
Yeah. It's remarkable how many broken models have outlasted their usefulness. Like the model that was used to justify austerity back in 2010 was proven to be broken fundamentally because of a misplaced decimal point. And we are still using it now. Speaking of the elections, like Starmer's government, they're still promising more of the same, like swinging axes.
Government in waiting.
I mean, there's not a great deal of change to be expected.
It's funny you mentioned Andy Burnham as well, Andrew, because I didn't meet him, but I was in Pompeii a bunch of years ago, and I saw him doing a tour of the city. I wonder what, there's probably some stupid political joke or metaphor there, you know. Won't be lava and sulfur and stuff, no, but yeah.
I think without wanting to get too much into the local politics, I think a lot of the metro mayors have been, you know, really successful. The ones who've been in post and sort of done, you know, had a bit of profile, they seem to be doing better than expected, which is a nice thing. Obviously I was involved in setting up various of the mayors some time ago, and you always think when you set these things up, is anyone going to care? Is anyone going to vote for them? And actually, you know, it's a nice thing, and it's relevant to decarbonisation as well, because you've now got these institutions in a lot of our big cities in England with someone in charge who can drive, you know, in terms of rollout of retrofit, in terms of planning for the grid and for heat pumps and so on and so forth, having a role that can coordinate some of that and make plans across, you know, a city region is quite a useful thing that we didn't have before. So it takes lots of different bits of the system to make this all work together. And I've dabbled in a few different bits of public policy in my time, so it's nice to see some of them occasionally come together.
Have you done background intro stuff?
Yeah, Andrew's given a background. And I should say down as well that I might have to, I'm not sure, I'm waiting for, let me know, I might have to leg it, pick up the kids.
All right, we can deal with that. Such is life. All right, so since you gave us what felt like an apposite moment for a segue into the episode a moment ago, which is lost now, I'm going to use it anyway. So thank you very much for joining us, Andrew. The reason we asked you on today was because of that magnificent Twitter thread that I received from a number of different people. Like I said, it popped up in my timeline, and I received it from a couple of people on the day, including Andy Simmons of the AECB, who shared it with a group of us. Well, you asked a question, why have heat pumps become a bit of a contentious topic in the UK? And you delivered a thread that made some effort to tie all of the various threads together. I mean, that you could within a single thread without it being onerous. And I thought, it was a really good distillation, which touched on most of the key subjects and addressed the weirdness of the bad vibes nature of the UK's response to this. I mean, how old are heat pumps as a technology? Like a century old, perhaps? Longer?
When was
the first refrigerator?
it's longer than that. I'll give you a specific date in a minute.
There's definitely talk about sort of heat pumps being trialed in the 19th century. I mean, it's not far off as old as Carnot himself, is it? Which is, you know, ultimately once the thermodynamics was kind of figured out, people started to try and apply it to this kind of thing. So it's not, it's certainly not new science, that's for sure.
But we are, it does feel like a weird thing, like a really parochial issue that we are inherently suspicious of the technology. So like with that in mind, what, because you describe yourself as being late to the question, but wanted to have a go at tackling it regardless, and you did well. Like, we'll include a link to the thread in the show notes, but what, before we get into the detail, like what moved you to bother?
So the original tweet came from Tom Forth, who is someone I know and respect highly. He doesn't work in sort of climate change, but is a really influential thinker around lots of aspects of economics and local growth and so on. And he was just, you know, asking the question, we seem to, in the UK, have kind of uniquely bad vibes around heat pumps. And it's one of those things where you think, oh, I know the answer, and you're desperate to pin it down to one thing. But I actually took me a few days to figure out why I thought it was, and you know, to try and pull together some of the different threads. And I think ultimately everyone can say, oh, it's down to this particular force or this thing. But often what happens is you get a bunch of different factors that have kind of pulled together, and suddenly you have a whole series of people saying things that maybe aren't quite true about heat pumps, or that are sort of feeding this very polarized kind of people. Some people absolutely love heat pumps, some people think they're the worst thing ever. And I just wanted to get under the skin of how on earth can we in Britain have got to this place where this quite boring technology that's been around for a while, how can it have got to a place where we have huge arguments about it? Apparently, if you're writing for an online newspaper, you get a lot more clicks if you mention heat pumps. It's a thing that people get sort of like triggered and pulled in on heat pumps. The original thread that we're talking about seemed to get way more views on Twitter than it should have get. I presume there was some kind of algorithm boosting, you know, people seeing that thread, and it probably seemed to be because it was about heat pump controversy. And I was just trying to understand, how have we got to a place where no one talks about tumble dryers or fridge freezers or anything else? How on earth have we got to a place where heat pumps, which are, let's face it, they're white boxes with a fan in them for the most part, and not excluding, you know, your ground source heat pumps and other types, but they're not that exciting really. So how on earth have they become this sort of big contentious issue? It's weird, and I just tried to piece together how we've got to that place.
So do you want to lay out some of the key points of your thesis? Is that fair to do to you, in fact?
Yeah, no, that's fine. So I guess what I started by trying to do was to say there's two different questions here. One is about why there aren't many heat pumps in the UK. So compared to kind of the rest of Europe, the UK seems to have roughly the fewest heat pumps per person, which is a thing in its own right. But that the reasons for that are things we know pretty well, we research pretty well. It's things like, you know, the cost of heat pumps, it's things like the cost of electricity relative to gas, which I'm happy to kind of, I could talk all day about those things and, you know, work heavily on those. But the question of why the vibes are so bad specifically is the bit that I wanted to get into, because, you know, it's a technology that about 1% of homes in the UK have. Why is everybody so keen to talk about them? Why have we got this kind of controversy? And I guess there were kind of two parts which seemed relevant to me. The first was about the industry and the message that sort of taken hold within some parts of the heating industry. And ultimately, maybe dig into this a bit more in a moment, but the thing that really matters in the heating industry is the people who install and maintain heat pumps and boilers. It's the heating engineers. These are the kind of the key heroes in this transition. They're the people that probably matter the most of anybody. And a lot of them, I think, have been, you know, given a message that heat pumps don't really work, that they can wait for hydrogen or other technologies. And that obviously is really crucial, because these are the people we need to install heat pumps, and these are the people we also need to tell people in their homes. They're probably the most trusted people. If you're looking to think about changing your heating system, getting a heat pump, the person you probably rely most on is your heating engineer. So that heating engineer community, and how, I don't think it's in any way the fault of heating engineers, but a lot of them have picked up a message that heat pumps don't work, wait for something else, which is significant. And then the second side was, it was the thing about fabric and how we have this sort of narrative that heat pumps don't work in Britain. And I think some of that's about it coming from, you know, leaky homes. Heat pumps don't work in leaky homes. And some of it's about the weather, and you know, heat pumps don't work in the cold. And none of these things are quite true. You know, the cold thing is complete nonsense. Scandinavia is probably the heat pump capital of the world, and yet, you know, it's clearly colder than it is. And likewise in the UK, Scotland, Northern Scotland has the most heat pumps per household. It's the coldest place. So there are some of these narratives that have come through. And I think what's kind of happened is there's a complicated journey that we've been on, but we've been on a journey from a lot of people saying, it's really good to upgrade fabric. The UK has a really big problem with insulation, and therefore you should focus on this. We've somehow morphed that message into a kind of, you know, a decent message of, think about your fabric, think about heat sources. We've somehow morphed that into a message of heat pumps just don't work. And it gets kind of past, you know, we've almost, with good intentions, Chinese whispered a message that a lot of people hear, and they'll think, well, I'm just not going to get a heat pump because they don't work, because that's what everyone says. So I think that was the two sides of it, was a kind of some parts of the heating industry that probably weren't trying to do the right thing and were trying to block heat pumps, kind of passing on a message to heating engineers. And then some of the people who are trying to do the right thing and are trying to upgrade homes, sort of leaving people with a message that that basically heat pumps don't work in leaky British homes. And I think that those two bits are things we need to kind of try and challenge and tackle. And it's difficult because it's not like heat pumps are challenge-free and perfect. There are challenges, there are things we need to address with them, but it's trying to do that in a way that's constructive and doesn't lead to these kind of, you know, to people basically getting the wrong idea and being able to kind of, you know, turn heat pumps into some kind of pantomime villain figure.
I wonder as well, for me, it feels like there are historic reasons why there'd be some pauses for thought. When I say this is the chair of the Heat Pump Association of Ireland, among other things.
He never mentions this. I think it's worth drawing our attention to now, Jeff.
I am an advocate for heat pumps.
You're the chair of the Heat Pump Association of Ireland, is it?
Right, yeah.
Well,
it's not a big deal. No, but the point is that I sound more important than I am, trust me. But the point is that that many years ago, I was arguing with, this is long before I was involved in this association, arguing with an official in the Department of Housing in Ireland over unfair treatment of heat pumps in our version of SAP. Specifically over that you were only allowed to count energy above a COP of 2.5 as being renewable in the regs as it was at the time. And when I raised this with them, it was still the primary energy factor of electricity, I think, was the issue. I think they were claiming 2.5, and we could see the primary energy factor of electricity dropping quite substantially. Mm-hmm. It's below 2 in Ireland now. I think it's even lower in the UK.
What does that mean, Jeff, the primary energy factor?
So basically, the way this works, primary energy is the energy at source. So if you use a kilowatt of electricity at the plug socket, in Ireland, it's like 1.94, I think it is, kilowatts, whereas 1.94, 1.98, I can't recall, at the power station. That's how much energy is required, how much primary energy is required to deliver it. So that you've got your generation losses and then some transmission losses to take into account. So that's primary energy as opposed to delivered energy or final energy, which is the stuff that's used in the building. And we were arguing for, you know, fairer treatment because we could see the primary energy factor dropping a lot. And the response from the official in question was to send links to me to the two UK studies, the Energy Saving Trust field trials. And there was one done like 10, 15 years ago, which was disastrously bad. It was like, you know, COPs of less than 2, but they were thrown in basically, I think, you know. And then there was another second one, which isn't quite so bad, but still not great. So I wonder to what extent it's not just blind prejudice, you know, and nostalgia for outmoded technologies that seem to be of a piece with the direction Britain's been going in the last few years. Sorry, I have to stick the knife in when I can.
No, I think you're right. I think that's a perfectly fair challenge. I think it's fair to say that if you go back 5 or 10 years, the case for heat pumps on their own was weaker. Heat pumps, like many other renewable technologies, have gotten a lot better recently. They've become more efficient, they've become quieter, and a lot of installers are starting to figure out how to install them much more effectively, which is really crucial. But the truth is that we still don't know how efficient. We know how efficient the best heat pumps are. The folk at Open Energy Monitor, who kind of all have the league table of, you know, installers and heat pump owners competing to get COPs above 4, which is, you know, really efficient. That's brilliant. We don't know how, you know, in all honesty, there are studies on this. We don't know how efficient the kind of average heat pump is. And that's a challenge. And you've got to try and raise that over time. And that is the primary factor overwhelmingly is installation quality. If you install a heat pump well, whether it's in a church or a, you know, brand new passive house, it will turn energy into heat really efficiently. If you install it badly, it will do it poorly. So that bit is really important, and there's a real challenge around it. I think the other point, though, is the cost of electricity, which is that there's the absolute key number that people call it, the spark gap, the sort of ratio of electricity to gas prices. In the UK, it's one of the highest ratios in Europe, and that's probably the key factor. We have a chart where we just plot electricity gas price ratio against number of heat pumps installed, and basically, you know, the places with cheaper electricity relative to gas had more heat pumps.
Yeah,
and the UK doesn't have, you know, has expensive electricity and it has few heat pumps, and it's not surprising because that is the factor which determines the running cost. And if you were installing heat pumps or renovating someone's home, 2-3, basically before the energy crisis, so any time between 2016 and say 2021, the electricity gas price ratio was 5-6 times often the price of gas, you know, was 5-6, you know, electricity was 5-6 times more expensive in the UK. Now That means that your heat pump would need to be, it'd need to have a COP of like nearly five, probably possibly more than five, to be cost the same to run as a gas boiler. And it's pretty obvious that in that situation, A, the heat pump's not very attractive. Like, I wouldn't get a heat pump under those circumstances, to be honest. But number two, if you're installing one, you're desperate to try and not increase people's energy bills. So what do?
Yeah.
You put in more insulation to compensate for the fact that otherwise it's going to increase running costs. And I think what that period did is have a lot of people say, you've got to have the insulation with the heat pump, partly because obviously having insulation is helpful and good, and it does help with the operation of the heat pump. But I think part of the kind of the only working well insulated homes was because of that, like your energy bills are going to go up if you don't do it. So I think that period and the kind of lessons for that haven't been properly worked through. And electricity gas pressure issues have fallen in the UK since the energy crisis. They'd back down at sort of, I think it's about 3.8. And there's also a lot of, there's a lot of people with solar panels and batteries. There's a lot of innovation in flexible tariffs, which gives the opportunity to get much cheaper electricity. But we've got to catch up with that and be able to say to people, okay, the thing you need isn't a kind of a set formula of here's the exact amount of insulation, here's the exact heat system. We need to flex to their circumstances and say, what's the best combination of stuff that I can affordably put in with a heat pump that's going to help you get really low bills and make this worthwhile? Sometimes that will be insulation. Often it will be include insulation, but sometimes it might be a battery. Sometimes it might be solar panels. Sometimes it might be thermal storage. You know, there's other considerations about how can we minimize bills. And I think there are a lot more options now than just the straightforward, particularly in homes that have solid walls where solid wall insulation is expensive.
Yeah.
That isn't always the most cost-effective option. And so being able to say to people, there's different ways we can do this, is really valuable. And I think we need to break out of that mindset of heat pumps don't work unless you insulate, into a mindset of we need to get the best package to keep your energy, get your energy bills down from this decarbonization of your heating.
It's interesting.
The key element is not the tariff reform. I mean, it's great to see some utilities coming out with flexible tariffs, and in Ireland there's a utility with a heat pump tariff. What they're advertising is a heat pump tariff, but it's just a question of trying to get people to sign up and use energy at a new window of off-peak time that they've described. So that's all great. And PV, I think, probably also does have a role, very obviously, in terms of when integrated well. But the elephant in the room here is the tariffs. And what can be done to offer sort of certainty that there'll be efforts in place to keep that spark gap as narrow as possible. Is that something that government should be doing, that the regulator should be doing?
Very simply, yes. This is one of, I think, I work a lot on policy around heat pumps and low carbon heating. The single biggest ask most people have is to reduce the spark gap, make electricity cheaper. The good news is that in the UK, we've got a great opportunity to do it. First of all, the problem, and I'm sure you'll have heard this story before, but we put quite high levies on electricity bills and very little on gas bills. There's also another thing, the carbon tax, the emissions trading scheme, which applies to gas power plants, which play a big role in setting the price of electricity, doesn't apply to gas in the home. I reckon it probably adds 1-2p on the price of electricity, which is not nothing as well. So there's a lot of these taxes where effectively we have like an anti-carbon tax in the UK on electricity around this. We're basically taxing the clean option and letting the dirty option go scot-free. So sorting those things out, shifting the incentives, and that's what the reason most European countries have a lower spark gap than the UK is not because they've got some sort of magic electricity sources, because they just tax electricity and gas more sensibly, and so everything stacks up. So just reforming the taxes and levies is the obvious thing. It's not a particularly difficult thing to do. It just requires, there are some implications about winners and losers and fuel poverty, but it's the kind of thing that a government with any political will and with a willingness to look at different options for helping people out who need more support should be able to tackle. And the kind of the costs of not doing it for the UK's transition are enormous, so it's a big problem. But there is another bit of good news, I think, which is that the reason that the UK and many of the countries has expensive electricity is because it's basically tied to the gas price.
Yes.
So most days in the UK, most of the time, the UK needs some gas plants running. And the gas plants, it's kind of what you were saying, Jeff, earlier about the primary energy point. When you burn gas to create electricity, I think you lose maybe more than half the energy. then you lose a bit in transmission and you've got additional costs. And so the gas, the electricity you get through is linked to the gas price, but it's about 3 or 4 times higher. Now, what's happening in the UK and in many other countries is because we're building out offshore wind in particular and renewables, you get more days, more half-hour periods where the renewables take over and run at this lower price. And so the gas isn't needed. That separates the prices. And it means that the market will eventually, once you get, lots more renewables on the system, the market will eventually start to be a bit more steady around the kind of contract for difference prices. And so you don't have to worry about always sort of floating gas. So we have this, one of the helpful bits of the transition is that it should start to make electricity prices a bit more predictable and also create those kind of periods where there's loads of excess electricity. So you can binge and, fill up your battery or preheat your home or whatever else. So there are some good changes, but the levies thing I mentioned, it's just the most obvious policy failure that needs to be tackled. And for some reason, the UK just hasn't tackled it and just needs to get on with it.
I get the impression that a lot of this has to do with our ties to the fossil fuel industries. Like what you described is like we are doubly subsidizing fossil fuels in this country. We subsidize the extraction and distribution in the first place. And then we, by the back door, subsidize the consumption of them by making the alternative too expensive. And you can sort of see that sort of mindset play out throughout the whole of the political sphere. Like, we are in hock to them people, whether we like it or not. As you can see with the opening of the gas fields in the North Sea, it feels absurd. And I think, so to your point, Jeff, earlier, I think some of this does have a significant chunk of this is down to our sentimental attachment to gas in this country. Because I think Nathan Gamblin mentioned this, that we have the biggest gas network, like infrastructure in the world, or the densest perhaps. But like no one else has had a boner for gas like the British. Like it just didn't happen. And that in itself is tied to our place in the world in terms of the Industrial Revolution. Because like with the proliferation of the railway, the proliferation of the gas networks was in order to keep the lights on in the factories. And ideally to make them a bit safer. And then all of that is tied up in this sense of overconsumption. So we're back to oil age architecture. And
so Dan, do you think that gas has, do you actually think that there's a somewhere in the ether with gas is the memory of empire?
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting
British people.
Yeah, yeah. but sort of, yeah. I don't think it's explicit. I think it is it's not the sign, it's the cosign. There is another aspect, like we've always done gas, like we've always been great. And there is this, like this unwillingness, this intransigence in the country, in all the country. In England. It's in England where we don't see why we should have to change. The world should change around us. And that is an attitude that we can see play out everywhere. And where we're talking about, so the alternatives are switch to electricity, fix the tariffs, exploit our people less. And that's not within the British mindset. We like a simple solution. We like the thing we've always done. And we prefer that. And so gas boilers as a mode of heating one's home using a hydronic system, we're all familiar with it. We know it works. It's easy to replace. It's easy to roll out. It requires less systems design. Because it is more familiar generally, and it's easier to install. You don't have to do calculations in the same way. You can have bigger radiators if you like, but you don't necessarily need them. And if it's too cold in our leaky housing stock, which is ventilated by poor construction, just turn the heating up.
Yeah.
That's it. And so it's like everyone gets it. It's simple. We don't have to think about changing. But now, if you think about installing a heat pump, like just looking at the comments last night in the thread, lots of people refer to having to change their, if I get a heat pump, I've got to rip all the pipes out and change all my radiators, which isn't true generally. Like you might be using the wrong pipes and radiators for your boiler anyway.
I'm hoping you're going to read those responses to me at some point. It's like the such and such reads mean tweets. But no, look, I mean, the UK had a really good run with gas.
Yeah.
We discovered gas, under the North Sea. And honestly, I think people underestimate in the 80s and 90s, particularly how much the UK economy was lifted by oil and gas. It was like 2% of GDP or something in tax revenues at its peak. And of course, the UK spent all of that on a consumption boom, and Norway, the other side of the North Sea, you put it all in the sovereign wealth fund. We had a good run with gas, but like you said, Dan, we have a really dense gas network. And there was the big switchover from town gas to natural gas, as it's cleverly named, in the 60s and 70s. And this is like the example everybody uses for the heat transition. It's like, oh, why not just do what we did in the 60s and 70s and send someone around to every house and switch it over? Heat pumps were a bit more complicated. But the bottom line is people used to have coal fires and a whole range of not particularly good heating sources. Suddenly you get this natural gas on. Big upgrade, you get your boiler, and of course in the 2000s we put in combis, which let you just, you know, oversize the combi so that you can get your hot water on demand. And it's, as you said, it's been really good for people. It's worked. It's not put a lot of pressure on the system. And gas was really, really cheap, and it was coming from you know, the UK continental shelf until recently. And it was only around the time of the financial crisis, actually, that the gas price started to creep up. It's been going on for. The energy crisis obviously blew up, but gas prices were increasing pretty steadily from around the kind of 2008 period. They've been creeping up, and we didn't notice. We were getting this kind of more and more expensive. We obviously knew under sort of the carbon bit, but we were getting this more and more expensive gas that we were burning, and it's just been eating into fuel bills and just increasing fuel poverty. And instead of, you know, insulating our homes, instead of thinking about switching to a cheaper, more sustainable source, we've just stuck with it. You know, we ripped out hot water tanks with the combis, which we're going to have to put back into most homes. And there's been that shift. And so I think we did have like a really long, good run with gas. We turned off all the coal power stations. You know, a lot of the UK's climate progress was turning off the coal power stations to switch over to gas and renewables. We had this brilliant run with it, but we've been too late to see that the honeymoon was over and that we needed to get on to something. You know, gas has become a really rubbish partner for the UK. It's become something that hurts us in a lot of different ways, the climate and the economy and fuel poverty. And so we need to help people get off and make that switch as quickly as we can. And we did, unfortunately, waste quite a lot of years just not addressing that problem.
Yeah, and we continue to squander them on a boondoggle like hydrogen. Like, hydrogen has its own place, but only green hydrogen is going to be of any use, and it's not going to be easy to produce, so we shouldn't squander it. And to use it for home heating would be squandering it. It would be wasteful. And it has been presented and represented and represented, and pilots have been sought and rejected unless they've been imposed, none of which demonstrate that it's a viable alternative. So, like, leaving aside the safety concerns, which I've mentioned quite frequently, so your point about the heating engineers, they're the ones who should be warming the market. But it's hard to change to another system. Like, you know, you've got to learn a new thing, which is a pain in the hole, fundamentally. And they are being misled by either boiler manufacturers who don't want to change because overconsumption suits them as well. Your view is your boiler, you've got to replace it sooner. And that isn't necessarily like a Machiavellian cynical scheme. It is just one of the outcomes of the way of oil age architecture and how it's had an impact on energy consumption in the country. And because they're mainly independents, they, as you say in your tweet, most heating engineers are independent and they rely on the big manufacturers for advice. If that advice is heat pumps don't work, wait for hydrogen, that's what many households will end up hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely true because they're the people they've had to trust for all those years. And if you're getting similar reference points from government and seeming activity trying to prove that hydrogen is the right thing to do, in spite of its rejection in Whitby Village and Redcar and blah, 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 like, why would you bother changing?
And on this point, Andrew, before I leg it now, because I will have to unfortunately run off, I think, I don't know if you thought about this in the context of hydrogen integrated into gas. But I'm really warmed by the fact that Nesta are actually thinking about the cost of energy. I think that's a point that many people in this debate ignore. You know, it's very easy to just focus on the carbon or the kilowatt hours and not think about cost. And therefore, that's really where this stuff interfaces with reality. If you don't consider cost properly, then it's going to be such a hard sell. Where does hydrogen come in? What's the case going to be? If hydrogen is going to be very difficult to do, does that not mean it's going to be very expensive in terms of the cost per kilowatt as well? Can we say that? Or?
Massively, yeah. So I think hydrogen is the kind of, you know, it's the caviar of the energy, of the kind of net zero energy system. It's the thing you use where you really can't get away with anything else. It's likely to be quite expensive. It you know, we talked about the kind of that you lose energy when you turn gas in a power plant into electricity. Well, when you turn electricity into hydrogen using an electrolyzer, which is the green hydrogen thing, the only thing that's really worth the net zero credentials, you lose a lot of energy, and that means it's expensive. You need I think the figure that connects with most people is the idea that you need sort of 4 to 6 times more renewable energy to heat a home with green hydrogen than you do with a heat pump. 4 to 6 times renewable energy. Like, I'm an advocate for building a lot of renewable energy, but like, we can't afford to squander 4 to 6 times more of it. Even in the kind of, you know, excess periods, we need to use all the excess, you know, when the wind's blowing really well, use the excess for battery storage, for all sorts. You can't just, and you know, there's an idea that we're going to build loads of nuclear plants or SMR, you know, small modular reactors to create hydrogen. Those things are expensive. You know, all of these things cost money. Energy is expensive, however you make it. And you can't afford to kind of, you know, flush that stuff, to use the kind of, you know, the caviar to feed the dog. And borrowed that from Colin Redfield, one of the top people in energy and heat policy. But you know, this is the bottom line is hydrogen.
So hang on, are heat pumps dog food then, if the caviar?
Heat pumps, like I said, heat pumps are boring workaday. They're the things that sit in your garden and do really good hard work. It's like, you know, it's like having a robot handyman that keeps you warm quietly. You know, hydrogen's for, you know, it's for making the really fancy industrial stuff. It might be for, I'm not an expert in transport stuff, you know, there might be certain cranes or kind of heavy machinery that hydrogen does, but it's for the, you know, yeah, it's the serious high-end stuff. It's not for the business of replacing us just keeping ourselves warm, because you can do that with electricity way more efficiently.
Exactly. I'm gonna leg it now. I'll be rude. I'm sorry, I've got to go and pick up the kids. So lovely speaking to you, Andrew.
The pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, Dan, don't like soil the, you know, just don't disgrace us in my absence. Yeah, I'm kind of worried not supervising you now. It's fraught with risk, but anyway,
really interesting. Thanks, Jeff.
See you later, love. So getting back to a point that Jeff mentioned, so I think it's, do we need to say anything more on hydrogen? Can we just dismiss it out of hand at this point?
I think that's the best policy. Yeah, hydrogen, massively important for net zero, not important at all, and a barrier to home heating.
Yeah. Like, so the other point Jeff and you both referenced, so tariffs that change the price of electricity in relation to carbon consumption. We can frame it like that. Great idea. It's complicated and alienating. Like, I was speaking to an academic, a researcher who's working on digitization of heating services. And like, without going into any of the detail of it, old people find it horrifically complicated, unless they're very digital old people. And many of them will resort to, rather than get to grips with the system, because it's impossible, and the whole service delivery itself is digitized, so all the support networks, blah, 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 there's no people involved, they'll just not heat their homes. And this is even people in sheltered accommodation, not like a pensioner living in their own house. And in addition to that, I find it really complicated. I'm a UX strategist. Like, I do digital for a living. And I look at that and my mind's boggling. Like, I don't want to do it as well. My brain sort of shuts down when I try and get to grips with it. Like, is there any route forward for this?
So I think flexibility and the idea of there being cheap electricity available is really important to the whole net zero journey. It's important because it's a route to make, you know, running heat pumps and other things cheaper. But it's important because we've obviously got to try and manage the loads on the grid, and the, you know, the periods, the kind of, you know, the evening rush when everyone cooks their dinner in the electric oven, or the time when everyone puts the kettle on after EastEnders or after, you know, the England football match or whatever. Those are like the really high pressure periods, so you do have to try and help to shift electricity demand. It's a really important part of our net zero electricity system. But I think the question about prices is really important, and there is a risk if we get that wrong that you basically end up with cheap electricity for the kind of the most affluent people, and expensive electricity for those who either can't afford the kit to access it, or who haven't got the space in their lives or the ability or whatever.
Or someone to do it for them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's not at all what anybody wants who, you know, is involved in net zero. You want people who are vulnerable, people who are older, people who don't have access to the kit to be able to access the same affordable heat and energy as everybody else. It's really important. It's a kind of net zero has to be fair, and making sure everyone can access prices is important. But at the same time, you know, prices do act as an incentive for people to, you know, you do want them to behave. You know, it is more expensive to use electricity at certain times than others. And the normal way we manage that is by making you pay more if you use electricity at the time when it's scarce. So we do need to find a balance where we're making sure it's fair, but you are, you know, you're making the system work and you're not letting people just be lazy and, you know, lazy is the wrong term, but not sort of letting people just ignore the kind of these things. And so you've got to balance those things. I guess my take on it. So the key thing really, I don't think my hunch, and no one really knows how this plays out. My hunch is that most people aren't going to be thinking about their energy demand every day. It's just difficult. People have busy lives and they don't have a lot of space to think about their energy or electricity use. So I think as far as possible, you've got to try and help people let machines make the decision for them. But you've got to do that in a way that they're comfortable with, they consent to, and that they can turn off and stop. And that's really important to get that balance between kind of consent and people's choice, but then not having to do it. But the thing is that a lot of the technology that enables those things, so it might be kind of, you know, home energy management systems, you kind of smart tech, but it's also things like batteries. You know, if you've got a home battery that you can charge overnight when the electricity is cheap, brilliant for you, but you've got to have a few thousand pounds up front to pay for it. And frankly, that's not everybody. Same with kind of solar panels to the same extent. Brilliant if you can afford it. A lot of people can't. The same with, you know, there's things like thermal storage, the idea that you run your heat pump overnight when it's cheap and it charges up your kind of your thermal battery, and then you draw down the heat when you need it during the day. All of those technologies are brilliant, but you've got to find a way to help people pay for them and make sure that and make them kind of intuitive and user-friendly enough that the people can use it. So I think that's the bit. And I don't have the answer to it. I think there's people looking at this, but it's really crucial that we've got, you know, schemes that help everyone take advantage of that. And so that's why I say, like, you know, the question of retrofitting a home these days isn't just about, oh, can we top up the insulation? Though that's important. It's a really important part of the whole flexibility equation. It's also about what's the right balance of technologies that's going to help this person, you know, have the lowest carbon, lowest cost electricity use. And the more we can do that and see retrofit in that sense of, like, when do you use energy and how can we make it cheap, the better. But it's not easy to do. You know, it's a complicated balance.
I think the insulation question is one of particular interest because it is inextricably linked from heat pump discourse, and it has entered its own level of discourse in which, thank you to Insulate Britain for getting it on the national agenda, but it also made insulation be woke. And I use that in the nebulous, nonsensical, pejorative sense in which it's used rather than the meaning which it was created with. I think, so I did, I just dug it out, actually. So back at the end of 2021, I did a very light touch textual analysis of heat pump coverage in The Sun, The Daily Mail, a bit of The Telegraph, and Which, and The Guardian as well. And broadly, like, they came back with much the same stuff, which overemphasized insulation or didn't mention it at all and just said heat pumps were expensive.
Yeah.
And since then, all we've, this might be confirmation bias as well, like, all I've really recognized coming out of the media is people saying heat pumps are a good idea, but they won't work in British homes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something, again, that we saw repeatedly in the comments in your thread. My favorite comment I found was, I have yet to hear of a single person who has installed a heat pump in their traditional 1930s house saying the house is still as toasty as with gas and they still have plenty of really hot water. All I see are people complaining about how cold their house is now. And it's a funny one. Like, there's more, all of these appear to assume something really significant. Like the last one I've got here. I think everything you've identified is logical, but I suspect it's also an issue about our housing. Our houses are cold, drafty, and damp, while many homeowners are mortgaged to the hilt, lack the capital for significant investment in the home. Hardly an ideal context. Like, they are all things that you can easily pick out of any vox pop or bit of discourse that you see around the subject. I don't know where I'm going with this, to be honest. I just think the insulation thing is really fascinating.
I think so. You should definitely read those tweets out of me and let me respond at some point. That'd be really good. I think the thing is, with all of the complaints, there is something in them. You know, it's not, as I said, heat pumps are not perfect and they're not totally straightforward. So if you take the disruption of having to replace pipes and radiators and pipes and then redecorate, the truth, as far as we know it, is that some homes don't need any extra work in terms of radiators and stuff. Some homes need a few radiators replacing, upgrading. Some homes, and this is probably not, it's probably a minority, there's probably a smallish number of homes, but we don't know for sure, need quite big work on the pipes. They've got pipes that are too small for a heat pump. But there's probably a heat pump solution of some sort that's going to work in that home. The problem is that what people do is they take the worst case and they go, oh, look, all homes are like this. And it's not the case. Homes are all different. Even homes that are built to the same plan end up being a bit different inside. People are all a bit different. And the idea that you can just take a blanket, you know, they don't work or whatever, isn't true. The reality is that, you know, a decent heat pump engineer can get a heat pump into most homes. Yes, in some cases, you'll need upgrades to pipe work and radiators, and that is difficult. No getting away from that. But for the most part, that's not what you need. And why do we focus on the kind of 10% of, or whatever it is, you know, the small number of hardest to do homes, when there's a whole bunch of homes out there that could be done, and let's get on and do them and grow the market, make them cheaper. And I think, you know, some of these things as well just represent people not having seen heat pumps in action. Now, there's a couple of things we've done at Nestor on this. So one is we did a survey of people with heat pumps. You know, ask them about their heat pump, and most of them, you know, 70% plus said they were happy with their heat pump, happier with the heat pump than what they had before, and it was about equivalent to what people thought of their gas boilers. So the people who have heat pumps in general, when you survey them on a representative basis and a kind of large basis, they do generally quite like their heat pumps. And the other thing then that we're sort of working on is trying to help people see that, because we know that people who have heat pumps broadly like them. So we want to get people to be able to see it. So one of the services we've launched recently is called Visit a Heat Pump. And basically, you can go online, sign up to look for a real home with a heat pump in your area. You go and visit it and, you know, hopefully get to see that it's actually pretty boring, works nicely, could probably heat your home, speak to the owner to find out, you know, the goss on how it works. And again, it's that process of just all of these things are things people are saying on Twitter or in the Telegraph or wherever. When you actually get to the reality of what the most homes look like with a heat pump, they seem to work okay. They seem to be decent and they're getting better over time. I think the thing we'd be saying is let's try and challenge these stories, the kind of people taking the worst case scenarios or the scare stories, and not ignore the fact that there are challenges with heat pumps and they, you know, in some homes they're tricky and they, you know, there are still a number of things we've got to solve with them, but let's not, you know, let's deal with those things and get on with it and the reality of how they are, rather than some story that people hear without ever actually having seen a heat pump or really having a clue what they do.
I suppose, like, taking a leaf out of the corporate marketing book, you just do case studies that show the viability of a thing. It's not the same for everyone, but here's how it worked in this circumstance. Because, like, having had conversations with Kenzie Utilities about their Heat the Streets, so we had Lisa on last year. That was a really interesting episode. So anyone who's not heard it, go back. I think it was August or September last year. It was sunny, so I recorded it outside. It was lovely. They're using ground source heat pump, heating a limited heat network.
Yeah.
And they're not overemphasizing insulation because they've demonstrated that they know it works. Yeah. I suppose they're doing that with their own customers. And we had Nigel Banks of Octopus offering his Fabric Fifth approach, his idea, his philosophy, which has adopted the sort of tenets of what we're talking about today. Yeah, it will work. Like, there are things that you can do to, I mean, I can't remember them off the top of my head, what the five things are, but broadly, it's like, improve the fabric of your home a bit, get a heat pump, improve the fabric of your home a bit, get the right tariff with some storage capacity.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, do the deep fabric when, I don't know, you've demonstrated savings, you've paid off the investment in the heat pump. I think ROI in terms of heating technology is a terrible approach. my feeling is it really should be subsidized. Given that we're subsidizing gas and oil, etc., why aren't we subsidizing this, since it's something we definitely need to change? Just set the money off of them and give it to people who need it, because it's a change that has to happen somewhere. I know it's an absurd idea in reality, but...
I think Nigel's Fabric Fifth approach is certainly provocative. I think it's one of these things where I would avoid, personally, with the idea that fabric is first or fifth or wherever. It's just the right thing for the home, as far as you can get it. But I think where Nigel's right is, I think he's right on a lot of things, but I think where he's particularly right is the idea that you don't have to conform to this kind of perfect order, and you can adjust your system a little bit later on. You can put these things in, you can make adjustments, you can try and, you can upgrade the radiators later if you want to try and get a bit more efficiency, you can upgrade the fabric. And obviously in an ideal world, we'd all perfectly renovate our homes and make everything perfect. But who can afford to do that? Who can, how often do you have a window where you can just kind of like uproot your life and let someone deal with all those things? So the idea that you can make adjustments, whether they be fabric first or the heating system first or whatever else, the idea that you can make those adjustments is, I think, really important. The bit that is non-negotiable is we do have to get everybody to get rid of boilers. We've got to stop burning fossil fuels in our homes. So there's different paths to it. But the one non-negotiable, if we're to have a safe climate, is that we've got to make the switch away from using gas-threatened homes. It's also worth saying that the Kensa team, we big fans of what they do. We went to visit their factory in Cornwall, the Nesta team, last year, and they took us to a National Trust property. I think it's Trelissick House. It's heated now by 6 ground source heat pumps. There's a really good picture of my boss, Madeline, sort of taking a good look at the heat pumps. But this is like a gigantic manor house with insulation is not really the kind of word you used to describe it. And there it is being heated by the Cornish soil, in effect. This idea that, they only work in perfectly insulated houses. They work in churches. They work in National Trust properties. These things go in and they work. The point on the Kensa side, and this is something people get lost on sometimes, is speaks to the point about flats, is that actually an air source heat pump is the most common type of heat pump. It's not the right one for every property. Mm-hmm. And there are other types of heat pumps. There are the kind of shared ground loop systems that Kensa and other companies do, where you have a little heat pump in your home and you put the infrastructure into the street. Really good for kind of slightly denser areas, maybe denser terraces, maybe flats, certainly kind of some social housing blocks. There are heat networks. In where I live in Bristol, there's a giant heat pump by the river that heats thousands of homes. It's sort of, it goes on a pipe under the river, but it's a giant heat pump. Brilliant. That one's water source. There's obviously the kind of air-to-air or kind of aircon option. We do need to kind of recognize that there are different solutions, and particularly in urban areas, it isn't just going to be, you've all got to strap an air source heat pump to the side of your flat. There are going to be a mix of solutions, but we do need to think about the way that we deliver those, because it's a slightly different thing. If you're trying to get whole streets or kind of blocks to sign up, you do need a slightly different mechanism for helping people sign up and make that work for people.
I suppose this is down to this is a common issue across all of the sort of green building sector and related sectors. Like, the language that's used to describe it is often alienating or inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you just described, there are many kinds of heat pump. There isn't just one kind of heat pump. And so selecting the one that's right for you, and people who may be procuring them for themselves might not be acquiring the best advice to find the right one for them, which isn't a problem with gas boilers, because you just get a big one that's too big and you run it too hard and it's easy. And it's a bit the same with retrofit. I've been complaining about the name retrofit a lot, like for years. And I think I've reconciled where I have a problem with that. It's that retrofit is like the broadest term of the practice,
mm-hmm.
not what you actually do. And you don't necessarily need to describe it in terms of value. When you go to the dentist, you don't go for a dentistry. You go for a checkup, or you go for a root canal, or you go for a fill-in, or you go for a clean. Retrofit's much the same. Like, borrowing from what Fionn Stevenson recounted that analogy to us, because it makes sense if you're dealing with retrofit at a mass scale. Anyway, I think heat pumps probably suffer from the same issue. We shouldn't be talking about them as a homogeneous mass. It's lots of different solutions for different circumstances, and there is always one, but we we're just not sophisticated enough in how we communicate it yet.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, unfortunately, the people who want to try and throw shade on heat pumps will pick up on the worst example. You hear stories of people saying, oh, heat pumps aren't expensive. And they've picked like the most expensive brand heat pump, which is designed for some like manor house in Surrey or something. And they're like, every heat pump will cost the same as this. It's like, maybe we could all live in manor houses in various county shires if we so wished. But that's not how it is. And so, you know, it's that issue of people cherry picking bad examples and then thinking that's what a heat pump is. And I think we just need to get, like you're saying, that message of, there are different heat pumps. There is going to be something that's going to work in your home. It'll take us a bit of time to figure it out. This heat pump journey it's a 25-year piece for the UK. Some people will get them soon. Some people will have to wait a bit longer. But we've got to make it such that everyone's got an incentive to move forward in that queue, that everybody has an idea of what they could do with their home and, you know, how they get on this journey. And we need everyone to know that they are going to have to make the switch at some point because they are. You know, you can't leave. Unfortunately, it's not going to be a sustainable state of affairs to have boilers bringing in gas and spewing out, you know, the kind of the stuff that comes out of the flue of your boiler, sort of haze it casts on over your neighbor's garden or whatever for much longer. We're going to have to move in this direction. So helping people, you know, see the path through that is important. And yeah, more case studies, more seeing people doing these things. But there's absolutely the game we've got to be in is just showing people that heat pumps do work. They're not that big a deal. They're actually pretty boring, but it's an awful lot better for the planet and for people and communities to have the most modern form of heating, which is basically these.
So where are we up to in phasing them out? Because there was a hard deadline, which was rescinded for phasing out of gas boilers in particular. Like, no more shall be sold and no more shall be installed. And I think the large developers have all sort of fallen in line in terms of switching the majority of homes to heat pumps. I think that's the case. But where's the hard stop now? Have you any idea?
Good question. It's changed. So new homes, if you're building a new home, there's a thing called the Future Home Standard, which effectively means you've got to put in some low carbon heating. That is due to come on stream next year, 2025. Mm-hmm. Apparently it will take a couple of years to kind of really cut through fully. But all new homes, I mean, it's madness that all new homes aren't already. Yeah, the idea that we're putting in new homes on gas is bonkers, but in a few years, it should be the case that all new homes are going to be low carbon heat of some kind, which is good. The second thing was the phase out date for properties off the gas grid. So properties that use oil or LPG or other kind of things that don't have access to the gas grid. It's about 15% of homes in the UK. Originally, there was a phase out date. It was penciled in for 2026 for those homes. And the reason for that is that actually, oil and LPG and those other things are less good options. They're less good than gas boilers. It's a much more attractive thing to switch to heat pumps. Most heat pumps in the UK actually are in these off-grid homes. They're mostly in rural areas. One of the things people don't realize is most heat pumps go into rural, you know, detached houses, cottages, etc. But that phase out date was in 2026. It's now been basically gotten rid of, pushed back to 2035, but kind of just left, which is a real shame because that would have been a very big boon for the heating industry. It was a big policy faux pas that was committed last September by the UK government. And then the big one was 2035. So we originally, Boris Johnson had his phase out date in 2035, where you couldn't install a new gas boiler or a new boiler of any type, apart from maybe biomass, in any home. So if your boiler reached the end of its life after 2035, you had to get something that wasn't a boiler, which was obviously most likely to be a heat pump or a low carbon heating system. What happened in September in Rishi Sunak's big speech is that he didn't get rid of that date, but he said that there'd be an exemption for 20% of homes. So 80% of homes would not be able to get a new boiler, but 20% would. No one actually knows how that works. I've spoken to quite a few people to try and understand, how would you decide on the 20% of homes? Is it going to be, you know, in certain districts that happen to vote a certain way? Is it going to be, you know, homes past a certain date or whatever? There is no, as far as I know, no detail on how that might work. And it's a very hard thing to make work. From our point of view, these phase out dates, they are contentious, but they're really important to giving the industry signals that by this date, this is where you need to move to. Because we know that about somewhere in the region of 1.5 million boilers get replaced every year. If you know that every one of those is going to be replaced by a heat pump or a low carbon heating system, if you're someone making boilers and heat pumps, you know exactly how many you've got to be installing by that day. It gives you a clear target that by this day, we've got to be all systems go on heat pumps or low carbon heat or whatever. Unfortunately, the ambiguity and the just sort of pushing back of the phase-out dates creates a situation where people aren't quite sure. The industry is thinking, oh, maybe there's a cop-out here. And of course, when you have this thing with a 20% opt-out, it's the same as when the UK used to have the 80% reduction in emissions target before net zero came in. What happens is that everyone thinks they're in the 20%. So you might say 80% of people are going to be having to, you know, are going to have to get low carbon heating, but 80% of most people here are, doesn't apply to me because there's an exemption. And so that's the kind of the place we're at. And it is the risk is that you've sent a signal to lots of people into the industry. Oh, actually, there's a bit of softness here. And if you plug away at that soft patch, you'll get more and more. So absolutely something the government needs to do is be clear. 2035 is the date when you've got to stop installing boilers. And if we can get that back in place, it just gives a signal to everybody that, yeah, we've got some time to make this transition, but no, you know, no messing around after that.
Yeah, it's been a right old mess, that. All right, I think we're probably at time now. Is there anything we've not covered?
The one thing was I'd love to respond to some of the tweets that you were pulled out, but...
Yeah. Well, we've got time. Did any tickle your fancy? The first one I pulled out, and this was like a fairly random representative sample. Like, I'll switch when it's cheaper to run a heat pump than use oil for my home.
So I know Jason who sent that tweet. Lots of people are switching from oil to heat pump because oil's generally more expensive than gas. It's generally a good deal to switch to a heat pump, and you can lose your oil tank as well from your garden. But it is true, like I agree that electricity should be cheaper. So I hope that, you know, when we do get electricity prices down, that Jason will consider the switch.
Where is it? Did someone... Oh, yeah, that was it. Most people see the relatively huge investment with currently no hope of financial return. There's also the space issue. They're big and ugly, and siting isn't easy. For my house, even disregarding aesthetics, they're nowhere suitable.
So that's from Andy Thorby, by the look of it. Look, there's a couple of fair points there. One is that heat pumps are expensive. Yes, they're too expensive. We've got to get the cost down and particularly help people with the upfront cost. That's something we say, yes, government needs to take action on that. But there is a lot of scope for doing that. The space issue is interesting. Heat pumps aren't that big. We can disagree on the aesthetics. I think they're quite nice, but quite boring. But the point here is that if you haven't got much space at your home, actually, there are other solutions. There are things like the Kensah shoebox, which is the name that can, you know, with the sort of heating system going to your street, there are heat networks. It isn't the case that every home, if you haven't got space, you're not going to get an air source heat pump. There are other kinds of low carbon heating system, other kinds of heat pump that are likely to go there. So yeah, don't dismiss heat pumps just because you can't see where they would go in your home at the moment.
Yeah, I think it is worth, so what you described earlier, the Visit a Heat Pump initiative, I think that's really interesting. I don't know if you're aware of Mike Fell.
Mike does a couple of days a week. Mike is a co-conspirator, and we're huge fans of what Mike does and Pump Chic and other stuff.
Yeah, I often reference the Instagram channel. Like, it's glamour shots of heat pumps. Like, I think it's brilliant. But I think as a counterpoint, like, lazy installation does create these problems. Lazy specification exacerbates them. And even well-considered specification, if the recipient hasn't been briefed appropriately, they haven't been primed for... So we visited sites, like, for sites of deep retrofit where the residents really weren't prepared for how big the units were going to be. And because of the nature of the project, they had to be sited in ways that it's not that they were, if they wanted to change nothing about their lives, yes, they were inconvenient. They were inconveniently sited because they were in a place that they'd used for something else. But if one is on board with making, accepting that something has to change, like, it seems quite reasonable. But I think the knock-on effect of switching to a heat pump is something that's interesting in terms of losing storage within one's home. which is something that is under discussed. But you have the same issue potentially with solar panels and all sorts of other issues. And I think this is an issue that needs to be addressed by the industry in terms of specifying, working on its own bedside manner, because plumbers haven't really had to hitherto. Like, you come, you do the job, it's the same nearly everywhere, within reason.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about those issues. But I think this is something that the industry needs to learn.
Yeah. The service has to be better. Ultimately, you know, there's a lot of things you buy these days where the service is really slick and the hassle factor is low. Heat pumps are nowhere near that place. And we've got to up game. Lots of people are working hard at this, trying to use modern technology to make these things run more effectively. And yeah, the industry, I'm absolutely clear the government has to change, but the industry has to change and adjust with this as well. And those that don't are going to get left behind, because if it's a real pain and takes forever to install your heat pump, fewer people are going to do it. But there's a lot we can do to help. There's a lot to help make that journey a lot slicker.
So how are you guys addressing, so the no hope of financial return?
Mm.
Like, how are you guys addressing that as a subject of conversation? Because you don't talk about the financial return on your boiler as it is. You don't talk about the financial return on your kitchen or bathroom, but we only talk about the financial return of heat pumps.
Yeah. No, you're quite right. People buy cars. They're much more expensive than heat pumps. Some of them electric, a lot of them not. And yeah, I get that a car can be, you know, a bit more exciting than a heat pump. I wouldn't deny it. But
all of the examples are more exciting than a heat pump, to be fair.
Yeah, you know, but
even Mike Fell would admit that
heat pumps take up less space and are you know, they're useful as a handy robot that sits in your garden keeping you warm. No, I think, look, the big thing for me is that the way people pay for heating will probably need to be paying monthly rather than paying up front. So that probably means using finance. If you look at how people buy cars, very few people pay up front 20 grand or whatever for a car. They tend to pay on finance, which means paying monthly. Now, the thing with low carbon heating with heat pumps is that there's a lot of scope to make the running cost, your energy bill, a lot lower because they're so efficient. And we talked about making electricity cheaper. If you do that, you can reduce people's energy bill, the monthly payment, an awful lot. Now, if you use the finance to do the other bit of the monthly payment, so you've got an energy bill that's a lot lower, you've got a bigger monthly payment for the finance, but the two things balance out, what you've got is effectively you pay the same each month. And as long as we can make sure that finance is fair, reliable, and it's affordable, and it's not sort of ripping people off, and as long as we can make sure those running costs are low enough, you've got a world in which you can make heat pumps cost the same over their lifetime and then translate that into a lower payment. And ultimately, if you say to people, and we've done testing on this, if you say to people, it costs this much per month to have a heat pump or this much per month to have a boiler, which you prefer, if the heat pump's lower, most people will go with it. And so that is the goal, is we've got to stop thinking about people forking out 10, 20 grand up front, because most people can't. That's not a realistic thing for most people. We've got to get into the idea of, we have an offer here where you're going to be slightly better off or the same off for making the right choice. And that is possible, and it's something that it just needs some policy reform and some nifty work on the financing side. But you get that right if you make the monthly payment cheaper. Why would you go with anything else?
So have you been speaking with any financial institutions about how to make this work?
Yeah, so there's a few different people looking at this. One of the most interesting is Legal & General, which is a big sort of pension fund institutional investor. And they're really interested in the sort of heat networks and shared rental. So they're an investor in Kensa, for example. And they've sort of taken this view that, you know, if you're a financial institution, you're always looking to reduce the risk. This is the big game. And heat pumps at the moment are risky because there's not many of them. They're a bit of an unknown quantity. And yeah, they aren't yet competing with boilers on cost. That's the bit that needs to change. But ultimately, for all these financial institutions, if you can make them less risky and you can make the return decent, they can put forward the finance and make it stick. And the less risky you make it, the cheaper it gets to borrow the money. So the game with this is making this stuff normal. It's making it less risky. And the government can help with that as well. When you've got new technologies, et cetera, government can help to de-risk them, in the jargon. You know, there's a lot of people in banks and financial institutions who'd love to be putting money into this stuff to helping fund it. But you've got to make sure that it's a kind of a good deal for both sides. And if you leave it really risky, they're going to charge you a fortune in interest and everyone loses. If you can reduce the risk and make it a safe bet, then everyone can gain. And so that's the name of the game with the finance side, really.
It is a peculiar conundrum. Like L&G, someone like that, you would imagine that they, well, Legal & General, not Light & Gas, you would assume that they would be actively working out how to de-risk this sector in order to make their investment pay off.
Yeah.
Because if the guy can make this pay off, that is boom time.
Yeah.
And it's long, slow, reliable money.
Yeah.
But there seems to be no drive to do so.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think too many financial institutions, and I wouldn't single out L&G there because, as I say, they're getting their fingers, their hands dirty with cancer and other, looking at investments in this. But I think too many financial institutions are kind of a bit in wait and see mode. And, I do get that. You do need the government to take a lead and show you the way. And there is more the government policy needs to do. But I'd also say financial institutions in general, they do need to make more of these loans. It's good for business. It's good for their green credentials, which are important to them and their investors.
Yeah.
But I'd love to see them be a bit more proactive, put a little bit more, risk money in. Because if you stake a bit of cash now trying to make it work, there's a good chance you'll be front of the queue when the market takes off and there's money to be made. So that's, I think it's fair that you want to see a bit less caution and a bit more proactiveness from banks and financial institutions. But I do also sympathize with the reasons they can't totally commit to it at this stage. There are certain assurances they need from the government at the same time. So you've got to get those two things right at the same time.
Man, it's tough. I think there's also like some of the institutions, they're from a macro level, they're playing both ends of the game. So as we saw with the housing crisis, a bank like Goldman Sachs found to be advising people on both sides of the debate entirely differently, the financial crash and the subprime loan market. One would assume that some of that activity is still going on, even in this space. I think the pulling out of the MMC market, the pulling of funding, the making that untenable, the modular construction businesses, I'm not singling out L&G, there might be a good reason for what they did, but the death of Ilka, like, these were financial decisions that were taken.
Yeah.
When, man, you would imagine big beasts like that, they have enough weight to make something, enough weight for it to project some influence into the market. But sadly, no.
These things are always difficult. And at the end of the day, we talked about things that cost too much. You can't prop up things that aren't working for too long. But people have got to take risks. It's a risk reward game. We're in the middle of a massive transition, which is going to create a lot of wealth, you'd imagine, at the end of it, if all goes well. And if you want to play in that game, it helps if you're able to put a bit of skin in the game and take some risk up front. And you'd like to see more people doing that. But there is also reality that you will make, I don't know the specifics of the MMC side, but there are also going to be bets which don't pay off, and you do have to walk away from those things. That's the nature of these things. We have to be prepared to kind of kill our darlings if things move on and we find out the thing we've pushed isn't the best thing. So you can't be too sentimental about this transition. You have to kind of go with the things that are winning. But at the moment, it's pretty clear that heat pumps are among those winners, and so you'd like to see a few more people taking a few more risks on trying to make the in terms of financial institutions, a few more people taking a bit more of a punt on trying to make it take off.
Yeah. All right. I think I'm going to have to call time now because I've got another meeting incoming. Andrew, man, it's been really lovely to have a chat, hang out, and I think it is a thread that I will be relying on and going back to, just because it lays out step by step quite succinctly what's going on, like why we have peculiar vibes in this country. And it's not just this country. I think heat pumps, I've mentioned before, like heat pumps in Germany, like sales have dropped off since they got wrapped up in the culture war.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Which is crackers. AfD done a good job there. All right, so all the usual things, join ACAN, join the AECB,
join the IGBC. All of these things are in the show notes. Women out there, check her own space. It's the community interested in renovation, retrofit. It is fabulous. Subscribe to Passive House Plus. Advertise if you can. It is a magnificent vehicle for doing so. It has an inordinately long shelf life, just to be clear. People are always referring back to it. They hang on. What else? Check Lloyd Alter's Substack, Carbon Upfront, and he has a book coming out. Now, it's only available in the States right now, but it's scheduled for release in Europe somehow. I don't know. I asked him about the details of that last night. I haven't heard back from him yet. And please, share this with people. If you get something out of it, you probably know someone else who will as well. So please share it with them. And if you could review it, 5 stars, please. It's all the algorithm really wants. And if you can't be asked, fine. That's fine. We are delighted that you chose to listen all the way through to the end. So cheers. And yeah, man, it's been really good to hang out. Thank you for joining us, Andrew. We'll speak to you soon.
Bye. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye.